Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our listening audience also, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight is the 12th for the year 2011 of our Monday Night Philosophy series, and during the holidays we always have a slight difference. Instead of food for thought, we have thoughts about food. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, personal chef E.J. Keller, also a personal friend. E.J.
Thank you, George, for the introduction. It's really a great pleasure for me to be with you all here this evening. And I would like to start with a little bit of background and some of my experience and how I came to be with you here this evening. I grew up in Orinda in the East Bay, and I went to a small liberal arts college on the East Coast for a couple of years, but I eventually ended up back in California. I got a degree in electronic communication from San Francisco State, which fortunately I never used. I was lucky enough to meet my wife, Isabel, who is French, in 1994, thanks to some mutual friends. We got married in Berkeley on the faculty club, on the campus at the faculty club. And a few short months later, we decided to move to France. And we left, we quit our jobs and had open minds and really had no plans. We ended up staying with my wife's family for about 6 months and traveling to visit friends and family throughout France. Her family is from a town called Châtellerault, which is in the Vienne department near the Loire Valley where all the chateaus are. But we also visited regions all over France, and this is how I was introduced to French food. Most of the time, we were sitting around the dinner table, or perhaps tea, or perhaps brunch or lunch, and I was listening to people speak French all the time. So this is how I got my introduction to the French language and French food. Now, we had visited Paris, and so we decided to settle in Paris eventually after 6 months, and we found a little apartment at in a neighborhood called Les Halles, which is a market neighborhood. There was lots of restaurants and food shops, and I was in heaven with my newfound passion for good food. So I decided that I needed a job, and I decided I would try and look in a restaurant. So I went to a restaurant, and I walked in, and they said, well, they didn't need anybody in the dining room, because I'd waited tables in college. That was sort of my first hope. But they needed somebody in the kitchen. And I thought, okay, fantastic. Won't that be great? So this is the first restaurant I worked at. It's called L'Escargot Montorgueil. It's in the first, and it has been a fantastic restaurant since 1832, former Michelin-starred restaurant. The chef there at the time, Thierry Gay, was pretty friendly to Americans. He had worked in New York and spoke English well, so he took me in on a part-time trial basis. After only a few days, since I had absolutely no training or experience, I was slicing and dicing and julienne cut of some endives, and I managed to cut right through my fingernail. And then the chef took me to the sink, and he told me to squeeze on it to stop the bleeding. So I grabbed a towel and squeezed on it, and I passed out. So I thought my culinary career was over before I'd even started. But Terry said no problem. He told me to go home and come back the next day, and it all went well after that. The next restaurant I worked at is called Jacques Cagnat, and it's in the sixth. And this was a former two-star Michelin. And they had a very big kitchen, great place, and this is where I really learned the meat and bones of the food world, literally. The most prestigious restaurant I ever worked at is this one. It is called the Grand Véfour. It's in the Palais Royal. And the Grand Véfour has been a restaurant in Paris since 1784. And it was a three-star macaroon and three-star restaurant in 2001 when I worked there. And they have some incredible history in this restaurant. Every table is named after the most famous person who ate there. So if you're lucky enough, you can sit at Victor Hugo's table or Georges Sand's table or even the table of Napoleon and Josephine, which is over in the far corner where the red bench is. Now, at this restaurant, we did absolutely amazing dishes. One that I recall is called the tête de veau, which is the head of a veal. So it's the cheeks and the tongue and the skin around the head all wrapped up. It's slow cooked and it's really, really juicy and tender and full of flavor. And it was a beautiful dish. And this dish took 17 different gestures to be assembled on the plate in the kitchen. It was literally a work of art. There was a piece of meat, there was the vegetables, some garnish, little sauces, decorations, herbs. Literally a work of art. And it was amazing. And I really enjoyed this aspect of the Grand Véfour. But after a while, there was something missing. The kitchen work was incredibly repetitive. In the time that I was at the Grand Véfour, for example, in a year, I only worked two stations, entremets, which are warm starter courses, and the fish station. And at those stations, I only had three or four dishes that I was working on. So I'm doing the same thing over and over again. And that was getting old. But more importantly, I wanted to do something different because I felt like I was missing something. What I had discovered with my wife's family around the dinner table at the beginning of the time when we arrived was the idea that the meal was really something special. All the things that go together to make a great meal. The food, not just the food, but the beverages, the table decorations, the greeting of your guests, the time you spend, all these things go together to make a package. And I felt like in the kitchen I was only getting part of that. I wanted to be part of the whole picture. So in 2004 I started my company, and it's called Carrot and Caviar. And I wanted something that worked in French and English equally well. And I wanted something that talked about food for the name of my company. Because I didn't want, you know, EJ's chef service. I wanted something that talked about food. And, of course, carrots are a very simple food. And caviar is, of course, very elegant. So I thought this was a wonderful balance. It was actually my wife's idea, so I should give credit where credit is due. So since 2004, I've been working as a personal chef. I do individual events for people in their homes, birthday parties, dinners, celebrations. I also work for some major brands like Henkel's, the knife company. I do demonstrations at trade shows for them or work in their shops to do training for clients and staff. And then since 2006, we've been going back and forth between France and California. We have two boys who are here with us tonight, and we want them to be exposed to both cultures. So we've been going back and forth. And so I've been doing the same thing in California since 2006, working as a personal chef, individual events for people. I've also taught a little bit in the culinary world at Diablo Valley College and Contra Costa College in the culinary arts department. And here I've also worked for some major brands, which has allowed me to travel a little bit in the U.S. and see some of the great food that we have here. So with the years that I have in restaurant experience and my experience in both France and the United States as a personal chef, I feel that I have a unique perspective, and I'm here to share that with you tonight. Now, it's something of a surprise, or it may be something of a surprise, that I was so taken by French food, because I grew up in a family where my mother, who's also here supporting me this evening, she cooked most every evening, and we almost always were sitting around the dinner table eating together as a family. So this is everything that's good. But in France, there was something different. There was something new that I had discovered, and I'll give you an example of my own wedding to illustrate. We got married, as I said, here in Berkeley on the UC campus at the faculty club, and we had a great ceremony outdoors during the day. We had a buffet dinner, dancing and music, all the wonderful things. We head off to the car, go off on our honeymoon, and all the guests are going back to the faculty club. The staff is putting away the chairs and turning on the lights, and everybody grabs their coats and starts to go. Well, the French contingency, which was unfortunately small, there was only a few people that were able to make it, but they were flabbergasted. They expected the party to go on for hours and hours. Never mind that the bride and groom were gone. Didn't matter. They were going to have some more wine, dance, listen to music. So when we went to France, in fact, we had an additional reception for the friends and family in France. And it was quite a different affair. We had it was held at this place here, which is called Senon-sur-Vienne. And you can see the Chateau de Senon in the background. It's a little park in a small town. The caterer set up a tent and had food. So we had a ceremony initially outside. Unfortunately, it started to rain. So we all dashed under the tent, finished the ceremony, and then sat down and had a nice long lunch. After lunch, the sun came out. So we went for a walk along the river and then played in the park and had a beautiful afternoon. The caterers had left all the food and everything there, so we went back and had dinner in the tent that evening. And then we all came back the next day and had a picnic lunch. It went on for 2 days. So this is really something special that meals have in France. And another thing that that I can tell you is, by way of example, is something I've done here in this country. I work occasionally for catering companies, and I did an event one time with a group on the USS Hornet for a high school graduation for some students. So they came in, I think, at maybe 6 o'clock in the evening, and they were immediately given some food to snack on as they arrived. About 8 o'clock, we put out a buffet dinner, and it was something innocuous, pizza and hamburgers probably. And then they got a midnight snack. And then before they left, at I think it was 2 o'clock in the morning, they were given egg muffins and breakfast food to go. And the whole time we were passing candy and popcorn and sweets. So it was food the entire time they were present. But they never sat down. They never took any time to appreciate anything they were eating. So this is what I discovered in France, that the mealtime and food is an integral part of culture and daily life. Now, why is it that this is the case? Why is it that French gastronomy is so special? If we look at the definition of gastronomy, we see that it is the practice or the art of choosing, cooking, and preparing and eating good food. So, the food you choose, how and where it's prepared, and the act of eating it. Three important points. So, why is it that this gastronomy concept is so special and important in France? And the best answer I can give you is that it has always been that way. It probably has something to do with the agrarian society that they have in France. If you leave the Montparnasse train station and go south towards Bordeaux, you come above ground after only a few minutes, 10 or 15 minutes, and you're very quickly in the rural countryside surrounded by farms and livestock and fields. And I think in France, people are very in touch with the rural community. It also has a lot to do, of course, with basic ingredients. There's a huge diversity, oceans on many frontiers, mountains, fertile fields, and the idea of terroir, which means that unique soils and climates in special places produce truly wonderful products, whether it's truffles in Périgord or cream from Brittany, where they have lots of green grass and great cows, or, of course, the grapes that make wine in Bordeaux and Burgundy. Also, cheese, of course, is a famous and integral part of French food. And cheese in France has developed in large part due to the distance that the producers find themselves from Paris. For example, in Normandy, which was only a couple of days' carriage ride from the center of Paris, they have the soft, fresh types of cheeses, which are Brie, or a Camembert, or a Livarot. In the south of France, where the cows would spend all summer in the mountain pastures, you get the large wheels of cheese, like a Comté or an Emmental, where the cows would be in the summer in the pasture all summer, and at the end of the summer they would come down and the cheese would make its way to the market in Paris. Another very important part of French food is the game tradition. And now this started, of course, with nobles and the lords who hunted on their own lands. But now, game is extremely important and popular everywhere. If you go to just about any restaurant during game season, which would be October through December, there will be lots of game dishes on the menu. And people love them. They're very popular. So these are all some of the aspects. But basically, the idea is that food has really been a fundamental and important part of culture in France. Now, in order to give you a little bit more information, I'd like to go back in time and look at the development of French gastronomy a little bit. Once upon a time, there was a place called Les Halles. Les Halles was a magical market that sprung up in the center of Paris every single day. About 6 o'clock in the evening, you'd have the most perishable items first, seafood, followed by the meats, and then the charcuterie, or the preserved meats and sausages. Then next, you'd have fruits and vegetables. And finally, about 6 o'clock in the morning, there would be flowers to decorate with. This is a picture of the Les Halles market as it was renovated by Baltard under Napoleon. So these are the Halles de Baltard, which is in the Les Halles market. Beautiful cast iron, glass structures, really fantastic. And so products came to Les Halles from all over France. And whether it was individuals who went to shop there for themselves, or restaurants who bought food there, or buyers who would then ship products all over Europe, the Les Halles market was extremely important and popular. So much so that actually in the 1960s, the traffic became unbearable. It was a nightmare. Every evening and every morning, traffic jams. And so eventually, in 1970, they decided they had to close the Real Market. Now, this was like ripping the heart out of Paris. If you go into the Saint-Eustache Church, which is on the border of the Real Gardens, where the market used to be, there is a sculpture in one of the alcoves called Exodus. And it depicts the vendors leaving the Real Market. And there, many of them are pushing trolleys with their food or a satchel on their back with produce. But they're all looking over their shoulder at the Saint-Eustache Church and the Real Market, and the looks in their face are pure anguish. Now, there are lots of other markets in France and in Paris as well. And, of course, there are many other remnants of the Real. One such item is a famous dish called bœuf à la ficelle. So this translated is beef on a string. Now, this dish would be, if you were a butcher working at Real Market, you'd take a nice little tender piece of meat and you'd walk across Real to the Pied de Cochon restaurant, which is still there today, very famous restaurant. And in the back of this restaurant, they'd have huge stock pots of French onion soup simmering away all day and all night. So you take your beef on a string and drop it into the pot and let it simmer until it's just tender and juicy and delicious. And this is what it might look like when it's done. So, in fact, since Charlemagne, there has been a practice of gathering the great foods of France to the markets and the center of Paris, the center of France, Paris, where, of course, the court and the nobles were. During the Middle Ages, a chef named Guillaume Tirel, who's also nicknamed Taillevent, there's a Paris restaurant named after him, he was the chef to Charles V, and in 1364, he published a book called Le Viandier, which means the meat vendor. This was essentially a cookbook. Now, at this point in time, books were still quite special, obviously. And the fact that this chef was able to devote a book to recipes tells us how important food was. During the Ancien Régime, we had, leading up to the French Revolution, we had extremely powerful guilds in France. And they already had very well-established roles. Whether it was the people that were supplying the foods or the people that were producing and cooking the foods or serving them in restaurants. So we already have the beginning of those 3 points of gastronomy. Also during this time, we had new world products coming in. Now, I believe that France has always adopted foreign elements and made them their own. And the best example of this is the potato. So potatoes started coming into France, and they weren't very popular until this gentleman came along, Antonin Auguste Parmentier, who had the great idea of planting a potato field near the Chateau of Versailles and putting armed guards on the field day and night. This way, when the potatoes were harvested, everybody wanted some. French cuisine reached its pinnacle under Chef Louis XIV, of course, and also as well under Napoleon during the period that's known as haute cuisine. Of course, the Chateau of Versailles was meant to impress all of Europe, show everybody how powerful the king was. And it was the same thing for the food that he served. So they had extremely elaborate meals, and everything was super deluxe. There is a movie called Vatel, in which Vatel, who is the chef to a prince at the Chateau of Chantilly, and the prince is receiving the king, Louis XIV, at the chateau. And of course, he wants everything to be really special. So the king and the prince and all the court are strolling through the garden, and at a predetermined location, literally up from the ground springs this amazing spectacle. There's a stage with musicians, there's a dance platform, decorations, and of course, a fabulous kitchen and tables for a great meal. The haute cuisine period was modernized eventually at the end of the 19th century by at places like the Hôtel Ritz, which was started by César Ritz at Place Vendôme in Paris in 1898. And his chef was Auguste Escoffier, who is here. Now, Escoffier was a fantastic chef, but in 1903, he published the Guide Culinaire, which essentially codified the entire restaurant system, everything that he did, and is still used in many restaurants to this day. Also at this time, we had the Michelin Guide, which began. Now, Michelin is, of course, a tire company. And the idea was that people were leaving the cities, driving around in their cars, and they wanted to find good food and lodging outside of the cities. So Michelin started a rating system. Now, the Michelin scale is actually not stars. They're called macaroons. It's a little symbol that looks like a French macaroon cookie. And so the highest rating on the Michelin scale is 3 macaroons. Then in the 1960s, we had a type of food called nouvelle cuisine. And nouvelle cuisine was lots of things. It was light and fresh and more modern. But the most important part of nouvelle cuisine was the idea that it was bringing food back to the regions. Now here we have Ferdinand Point, who is mainly associated with nouvelle cuisine. And he is shown here with his favorite friend, a bottle of champagne. But many chefs under Ferdinand Point, such as this gentleman, Paul Bocuse, took the nouvelle cuisine movement to the regions. So Bocuse cooked in Lyon, which is a very well-known gastronomy city in France. And the restaurants there are called Bouchon. And you might find any number of unusual dishes that were not necessarily at the court, but that were done in the same tradition, such as this dish, which is called the tablier de sapeur. And it is, in fact, tripe. So not a very glamorous ingredient, but it's cooked with a lot of aromatic vegetables, and then it's breaded, and it comes out extremely crispy, and in that fashion, it becomes a fantastic meal. So I think it's fair to say that food in France migrated originally towards the court, was glorified for the king, was then made available to all of the upper class at hotels and fancy establishments, but eventually moved back to the individual regions. So in this way, you can say that the food from the court of Versailles was available on every table in France. Now, this is a bit of a Francocentric history of food, obviously, and I'll give you a little example to show something that's going on elsewhere. In 1837, a famous restaurant opened in New York called Delmonico's. Now, they were the height of luxury in their day as well. And they had a French chef, Charles Ranhofer. And in 1893, so before the Guide Culinaire, he published The Epicurean, which was essentially the same thing. So to this day, if we go out to a fancy restaurant, it could be Delmonish, but rather it's ritzy. So I guess the French won out. So if we go back to our gastronomy definition, the choice of foods, where they come from, this is the first element. How many people here have seen this movie, Food, Inc.? Good. Okay, a lot of you, actually. That's great. You guys are all on board. So in this movie, they talk about the fact that food in this country travels, on average, 1,500 miles before it gets to the grocery store shelf. And this leads to all kinds of problems. When I've taught hygiene classes, there's an acronym we use, Fat Tom. And this stands for food, meaning the type of food, acidity, time, temperature, oxygen, and moisture. And these are the things that affect food spoilage. So because food is traveling for such a great distance and spending a long amount of time in transit, and because it is potentially subjected to temperature changes during that transportation, our food is filled with preservatives and salt and sugar. A fantastic example of food that travels is tomatoes. This is a book by Barry Estabrook called Tomatoland. And in this book, Barry talks about how tomatoes have been totally engineered now. They come out all the same size, green, very firm, so that they can be packed up and shipped all across the country from Florida, where a large number of them are grown. When they get to regional distribution centers, they are placed in houses where they are exposed to ethylene gas, which turns them red. It doesn't give them any more vitamins. It doesn't make them sweet and juicy. It doesn't change their texture. But the worst thing about tomatoes is that where they mostly come from, in Florida, there have been, in the past 10 years, 7 successful cases of slavery brought to justice. These are people who are bought and sold, held in containers, locked overnight, and literally forced to work in chain gangs. In the last 10 years, 1,200 people have been freed in the state of Florida from slavery. Exactly. Now, that's the bad news about tomatoes. The good news about tomatoes is that you can grow them yourself. It's really not complicated. I have a friend in Orinda who grows over 100 pounds of tomatoes every summer in his backyard. Look at some of his tomatoes. This is a Zapotec. These are Polish linguica tomatoes. This is a persimmon tomato. Tomatoes can be grown on a planter box on your porch. They can even be grown in a windowsill on a pot, in a pot. And there's nothing better than a vine-ripened tomato. Here we have some cows. Now, these happy-looking cows are not in Texas, and they're not even in the Midwest. They're actually in Ream Valley, which is a small community on the other side of the Berkeley Hills. Unfortunately, they're probably not going to spend the rest of their life in these hills. They are going to be shipped off to a feedlot, probably in Southern California. You might have seen or smelled the feedlot as you drive by it, but they might even go quite a ways farther. And they're going to be fed corn. And it turns out there's corn in everything. All those things you see on the labels: xanthan gum, maltodextrin, sorbic acid, high fructose corn syrup, all full of corn. In fact, there's a production system that has now allowed four companies in the United States to control 80% of the meat production. A company like Tyson can produce a chicken in 48 days, and they control every aspect of the production. There is a reason why a Happy Meal costs less than a pound of broccoli. The system has been skewed in favor of the large agricultural businesses. Now, in this country, I think we traded convenience for value. This probably started happening during the Industrial Revolution, but certainly after World War II, and a lot of it is attributed to a gentleman named Earl Butz, who was Secretary of Agriculture under Nixon. And he preached, get big or get out. And small farms in this country have all but disappeared. Now, the first time we came back for an extended stay, we drove across country. And my youngest son, Gabriel, who was extremely enamored with corn, was telling us every time we went by a cornfield. And by the end of Iowa, we were pretty tired of it. Corn, 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 everywhere. So I could go on, but I'm really not here to denounce the sins of corporate agriculture. I really want to talk about my passion for good food. So I'd like to do a little demonstration. I'm sure most of you know what's in this jar, despite the fact that I've taken the label off. I'm going to make some mayonnaise to show you how simple good food can be. Now, I've printed up my recipe, which is available on your way out. Be sure to get one. On this side, you can see sample ingredients in store-bought mayonnaise: modified cornstarch, sugar, high fructose corn syrup, xanthan gum, phosphoric acid, and the list goes on. Okay? On the other side, you have my French mayonnaise recipe, which has four ingredients: egg yolk, mustard, salt, and oil. And it's really, really simple. Now, I love mayonnaise. Mayonnaise, unfortunately, has a terrible reputation. But mayonnaise is a fantastic sauce that has great characteristics, good flavor, and is extremely versatile. So we're going to begin with an egg yolk. The recipe calls for half an egg yolk because mayonnaise is actually counterintuitive. The more oil you add, the thicker it will get. So in order to have a nice thick sauce, if you start with a half an egg yolk, you don't have to add too much oil. So egg yolk, a healthy pinch of salt, a little Dijon mustard, about a teaspoon, and then we're going to begin adding oil. Now, there are lots of old wives' tales about not answering the phone while you're making a mayonnaise, or never change directions, and all those types of things. But there's really only one golden rule that you have to follow when you're making mayonnaise, and that is to add the oil very slowly at the beginning. So you see I'm only going to add a few drops as I start the sauce. Now, mayonnaise is an emulsion, which means that elements that usually do not stick together, like water and oil, are bonded, literally on a molecular level together. And once those items are bonded, it's a very stable emulsion. And you can add lots and lots of different things, including liquids, water, to a mayonnaise, and not break the emulsion. So once I've started to add a little bit of oil, you will see that the mayonnaise goes from its dark yellow color from the egg yolk to a little bit more of a matte, dull, pale yellow. This means that we have established an emulsion. And now we can start to add the oil a little bit quicker. And you will see that the mayonnaise will eventually come out quite thick. As I said, the more oil you add, the thicker it is going to get. And it's really quite simple. The more oil goes in, the thicker it's going to get. That's all there is to it. Now, I've got carrot sticks, so you're welcome to come up and taste the mayonnaise at the end and see what it's like. And I think there's enough for everybody. I'm sure there's enough for everybody. But you can see that eventually when we get enough oil in here, it's really quite thick. I'm using canola oil. So this is a really fantastic, easy way to start off a lot of great recipes. I make my version of a Waldorf salad, in which I use endives, apples, dried cranberries, and some nuts, and I make a mayonnaise dressing. I add apple juice and walnut oil to it, and that makes a thick and creamy dressing for my Waldorf salad. Now, if you want a low-calorie version of a mayonnaise sauce, you can take just a little bit of this sauce and add lots of non-fat yogurt, and you'll still have the taste and the texture and the sheen that mayonnaise gives, which is really, really fabulous. So when I make this dish, the Waldorf salad, it's really a balance of the basic elements of the flavor world. There are four basic elements: salty, sweet, acidic, and bitter. So the endives are the bitter element, the apples are the sweet element, cranberries are tart, and the seasoned dressing gives us the saltiness. So when we're cooking, these things are really, cooking is all about a balance of those ingredients. So, as you can see, mayonnaise is really quite simple, and I believe it's really a great, great product. So if we remember the first part of our gastronomy definition, we're talking about the choice of foods, where food comes from. And I have to say that I'm really encouraged by the local food movement in the Bay Area. Locavore is a term that was invented in the Bay Area by Jessica Prentice. In 2007, it was the Oxford Dictionary Word of the Year. And it's the idea that good food doesn't have to travel a long way, but also that we can get really good, fresh, quality ingredients. And it's also about knowing who and where the products come from. This encourages seasonal food and diversity, but it also builds community. Because undoubtedly, food is part of culture. We all have great food stories, whether it's grandma's special pie or a fantastic meal we had at a special occasion. And the local movement really helps reestablish some of this lost culture that we have around food. Now, there are lots of varied implications of the local food movement, and I'd like to talk about a few in Berkeley, where I live. Oh, here's a picture of the cornfield that I chose. This is the symbol of the American agriculture system, the Red Barn, which is literally being swallowed up by the cornfields. So here's an organization called Transition Berkeley that was started by Susan Silber. And they have a crop swap. So if you have an extremely prolific apple tree in your backyard, you can take your apples and go to the Ohlone Park Greenway in Berkeley and trade them with somebody who grows carrots in their backyard. And in this way, it's an extremely inexpensive way to barter foods, obviously. It's healthy, it's local, it's sociable, and it builds community between the people that are part of the movement. Here is an organization called North Berkeley Harvest that was begun by Natasha Boisier. Volunteers last year harvested over 1,000 pounds of fruits in people's backyards and donated them to schools and shelters and senior centers in Berkeley. And here we have a map from Forage Berkeley, which was created by some UC Berkeley students. And each blue pin is a place where fruits and vegetables can be harvested on public lands or from public space like a sidewalk. So urban farming can be really a fantastic thing. And I think in California, with our penchant for technology, we can really improve on this and lead the way. And we might even be able to teach the French something. In addition to local foods in the Bay Area, we're very excited about lots of other things. For example, raw foods and superfoods. Raw foods, people often, unfortunately, think are a whole lot of salad, rabbit food, and raw vegetables. But raw foods can be really, really good for you. A good example is sprouts. Sprouts are full of nutrients, really flavorful, and they can be added to just about anything, a salad, of course, but you could add them to a warm dish at the end, and they would just wilt right into it, or put them as a garnish on top of soup. There's, of course, other raw foods, endless varieties of salads, carpaccio, sushi, nuts, Even raw fruit, a piece of raw fruit at the end of a meal is a great habit. A perfectly ripe fig cannot be improved by any chef. It's just waiting to explode in your mouth. There are, of course, lots of superfoods, whether it's blueberries or goji berries, and even George Bush Sr.'s favorite food. Everybody remembers that, right? Broccoli. Yeah, broccoli is a superfood, full of nutrition, and if it's cooked right, it can be splendid. There are great dairy products, yogurt, and lots of unpasteurized dairy products. There are several producers of unpasteurized dairy in California. And I've seen numerous testimonials of people who had lactose intolerance or dairy allergies who have absolutely no problems with unpasteurized dairy products. So all of this gives us an incredible amount of diversity, but also encourages moderation, a little bit of a lot of things. There's the French paradox, which Mireille Guyano talks about in the book French Women Don't Get Fat. Well, it is true. The French do not snack. They don't eat in between meals. They don't have huge portions of food. And they take the time. They don't eat fast. They enjoy their meals. And this does make a difference. Now, it's changing, unfortunately, but this does make a difference. In this country, we're always looking for new diets, and the fact that there are so many means that nobody's gotten it right yet. And often people are afraid of fats and sugars. Now, I worked with a chef at the Cordon Bleu named Marc Thivet, and he loved to tell the story about the Landes region in France, where he is from, in the south, where they raise a lot of duck. And in this region, they cook everything with duck fat. No butter, no oil. Everything is cooked with duck fat. And he would love to say, Chef Thivet would love to say, that because of the French health system, which essentially covers everybody, they have lots of data. And the Landes region, consistently for decades, has been the region that has the lowest high blood pressure and cholesterol incidence in all of France. And they're cooking with duck fat every day. Another really fantastic thing about the local food movement is community-supported agriculture. How many people here get a CSA box? Great. Okay, good. Several people. That's fantastic. We get a box from this farm, Eat Well Farm in Dixon, every week with my family. And they are also at the Ferry Building Plaza in San Francisco. And if you look on localharvest.org, there are actually 30 different CSAs available in San Francisco. They also index farmers markets, co-op markets or stores, and restaurants that use good farming practices. But community-supported agriculture and local food is not just about getting great food. It's also about being part of the process. You can go to the farm and help out. This is a picture with my family at strawberry days at Eat Well Farms. You can eat as much as you want, as much as you can pick, and you can buy strawberries at an incredibly reasonable rate. And when you talk to a farmer, either at the farm or a farmer's market, you see the passion that they have for food, and you understand the value that they are adding to that food. Now, I compare this with stores like Costco and other large retailers. In addition to feeling like livestock at the paddock when you're checking out, I think they've totally missed the point. In this store, what's valued is price and volume, not the value of the food itself. Now, when I was teaching, I was at Contra Costa State. I was telling some at Contra Costa College. I was telling some of the students about a dish we did when I was doing a stage at Chez Panisse, and it was a little piece of salmon, three perfectly sculpted or turned potatoes, some sauce, and a little garnish. And they were so amazed that this kind of dish can fetch high prices at a restaurant like this. And I said, well, the potatoes, of course, only cost a few dollars a pound. But the effort that the farmer put into those special potatoes, the relationship between the farmer and the vendor, the cooks that worked on that food, the people who serve it, all of that counts. It adds value to the food. And this comes out. So it's undeniable that food has value. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of Costcos out there, but this might change. And in California, we're taking a lot of steps in the right direction. In 2008, we passed Proposition 2, which was the animal rights bill. And California is, of course, a big agricultural state, so we're definitely leading the way here. But this demonstrates a good point. Prior to Proposition 2, only 10% of the eggs sold were cage-free eggs. But 63% of the people voted for this law. So lots of people think it was a great idea, but only some were actually able to or doing it on their own. We need good policy to encourage good decisions. The Food and Agricultural Act, or the Farm Bill as it's known, could be an excellent vehicle for encouraging good decision-making, yet it continues huge subsidies. And these subsidies have been resoundingly criticized by the United Nations and the World Trade Organization. The current administration, unfortunately, hasn't changed things very much. Obama campaigned on a pledge to support small farmers, and yet the 2010 USDA policy continued loopholes that allow some companies in this country to get seven-figure subsidies from the government. This is partially due to the large lobbies that these companies have and the litigation forces that they have. A great example is the case of Oprah Winfrey versus the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Oprah made a comment about never wanting to eat another hamburger again after the E. coli breakout, and the cattlemen took her to court claiming that they had lost income. Now, they probably knew that they weren't going to win. Oprah was the winner, or was not found guilty and was not made to pay any charges. But the message was sent. These big businesses wanted you to know that you can't mess with them. We have a company in this country called Monsanto. They created Roundup, which basically kills everything. Then they created soybeans and patented them that resist Roundup. And now they have a 90% share of the soybean market. How is that fair trade? And then we have mad cow disease. Now, it's pretty well understood at this point that the process of rendering bovine protein, which is essentially grinding up cows and feeding them back to cows, is what is at the base of the mad cow problem. And yet, this problem has not entirely been discontinued in this country. So we really, really need good governmental policy to encourage and facilitate smart and wise food choices. And that will help the local food movement be common everywhere. And wouldn't that be great? So if we go back to our definition of gastronomy, the second element is the act of preparing or cooking the food. Now, this is great. We have tons of cookbooks, websites, TV shows, all kinds of stuff for food these days. And so much so that certain chefs, like Thomas Keller, and in case you're wondering, we're not related, but these kind of chefs have a rock star status in our culture. And I think it's a little bit over the top. The best chefs that I know are the ones that are in the kitchen. So we probably all can't be great chefs, but we should all be good cooks, and we should all cook. If you look on Yelp, there are 50 cooking schools in San Francisco. I work for a cooking school in Berkeley called Kitchen on Fire. At this cooking school, you can do basic, very, very basic classes, advanced cooking, all kinds of different ethnic foods. You can do private events with friends or your family or your company. Lots of options. We should all cook together with friends and family, and not just for special occasions. Of course, everybody goes to town on Thanksgiving to produce a fantastic meal, but this should be an everyday occasion. And education for kids really, really has to be a priority. Unfortunately, far too many kids see nothing but shrink-wrapped meats and aisle after aisle of grocery store foods. And then in the schools, they're subjected to sponsoring and marketing and vending machines full of terrible junk food. Food can be an extremely valuable vehicle to teach. I have a friend in Watsonville who worked with a program that taught teachers how to teach all kinds of things in a garden, not just food, math and science, lots of options. So we really need to learn about food, and there's no better way than to get hands-on time with the products in the kitchen. And cooking can be extremely rewarding and fun. When I cook with my kids, whenever they've helped me prepare some food, they're much more likely to eat it, and they usually appreciate it. Now, the third element of gastronomy in the definition we looked at is the act of eating. So now we get to the good part. Unfortunately, I don't have to tell anybody to eat. We eat far too much. The International Obesity Task Force tells us that there are 1 billion overweight adults in the world. This graph, dark blue, is 25% obese population. In the United States, about 25% of our healthcare expenses go to blood sugar and weight-related problems, a quarter of our health care budget. Diabetes is a terrible, terrible disease. The World Health Organization tells us that there are 350 million people in the world with diabetes. 80% of them are in low or middle-income countries. And the sad thing about diabetes is that it is almost entirely preventable. A healthy diet and a reasonable amount of exercise is enough for most people to avoid diabetes entirely. And the really bad thing is that it's getting worse. Childhood obesity and diabetes is growing. In this country, 1 in 3 children born after 2000 is expected to contract early onset diabetes. 1 in 3. This is a serious healthcare problem that our broken healthcare system will not be able to handle. And this is the kind of thing that has contributed to the Occupy Wall Street movement, the idea that Congress and government don't listen and that only money counts. The Occupy Oakland movement had a kitchen, and they were cooking food every day for anybody that wanted it. And they also had an herb garden that they'd planted in the planter boxes around the square. I think it's also fair to say that we are exporting obesity and an unhealthy lifestyle. If you get off a flight in any major city around the world, we see the same things all the time, whether it's electronic communications, entertainment, music, movies, or the same Starbucks and McDonald's all around the world. When I moved to France, for 5 francs, which is about $1, you could get a cup of coffee or a glass of red wine, depending on the time of day, and sit on the cafe sidewalk terrace all afternoon. And this is nothing new. Of course, Hemingway went to Paris and sat on the sidewalk cafes. The first Starbucks opened in Paris in 2001, and there are now 50 of them. It opened in 2006, and there are now 50 of them 5 years later. So now you got to get your grande latte and your muffin, and you're going to pay €5 for this. This is not food with good value. Now, I was not the first one to go to France and discover great food. Alice Waters got her spark there, and of course Julia Child mastered the art of French cooking. When we travel, we need to find good things. We need to take the time to explore and discover and not flock to the chain stores. Now, the idea of a great meal, enjoying good food, was something that I thought to be a little bit missing. So I came up with an idea, the Carrot and Caviar Supper Club. I started this in March of this year, part of my company, and it's every Thursday night, and the idea is, basically, it's a group of 10 or 12 people, it's hosted by somebody I know in their home, so it moves around the Bay Area, and it's open to anybody. You're all welcome any Thursday evening. So it may not be people you know, you meet some new people, great conversation, have a nice meal sitting around the dinner table, and really have a fantastic evening. Now, of course, we don't have great meals only at home, we can go to restaurants. And in France, the 3 macaroon restaurants, there are only 21 of them, and they are extremely special places. And even people who cannot afford to eat out very often, they will save up, and they will make the time to go to these special places. And at this kind of a restaurant, or at any good restaurant, service is what I really like the best. We ate at a restaurant called Pierre Gagnère one time, which is a 3 macaroon. And I went with a friend of mine, Jeff, who was a total foodie, so he brought his camera. And we're escorted into the dining room, and we get to sit down at our table. And just as Jeff sits down, he goes to put his camera next to him on the floor by his chair. And one of the dining room staff swoops in with a little stool for his camera right next to his chair. This is the kind of great service that really shows that people care about the food. And as I say, it can be in a great restaurant like the French Laundry, or it can be in your local bistro. So when we go to a foreign country, or just across the state for vacation, we should look for great places, great food. Enjoy. Bon appétit. So in conclusion, I would just like to say that we really need to make every bite count. Local, organic, variety, moderation. Huge packaged food doesn't have the value that food really should have. After all, we are what we eat. And I believe this is true on more than a nutritional level. Because we are what we eat, and because food is such an important part of our culture, we have an intimate and profound relationship with the foods that we eat. And though we may have currently deviated a little bit from good food practices, I believe that good food and great meals will always be important in our hearts and lives, just like they are important in the Léal market where I live, in the hearts and minds of the people of Paris and all of France and gastronomes everywhere. Thank you very much.
Listening to Chef E.J. Keller at the Commonwealth Club speaking on the philosophy of food, both in France and here in the Bay Area. So we're ready for questions. If anybody would have a question, you can come up to the mic. I thought one thing that I wanted to bring up was it seems to me that one of the reasons for overeating is that the amount of food doesn't satisfy because something's missing, and so people still stay hungry and keep eating. I don't know if you looked
sure.
at that.
There's another movie that I believe I have on here called Food Matters that talks a lot about nutrition. There's a movie that a lot of people have heard of called Supersize Me, a gentleman who decides to eat nothing but McDonald's food all day, every day for a month. The long and short of it is that his health goes south very quickly and he nearly dies. So the types of food that you're eating that don't necessarily satiate your hunger encourage overeating and eating often. Yes, definitely. Great point. Thank you. Question, sir. Please, go ahead.
Just a quick question. When you make the mayonnaise, why do you use canola oil rather than olive oil?
So technically, if you make your mayonnaise with olive oil, you have an aioli, which is different. You can make mayonnaise with olive oil. Most of the time in the recipe, I list canola oil. I can't remember if I say... Yeah, it says always start with canola oil. By the way, the first step of the recipe, I'll just mention this, is pour yourself a glass of wine. I believe that cooking should be fun, and that's the best way I know to start things off right. But most of the time you start with canola oil because canola oil is neutral. It also is very, very good for you. It's high in omega-3s. But canola oil has a neutral flavor. When you emulsify an oil, its flavor will often change. So if you take an olive oil and emulsify it, it's actually very, very strong. So even for an aioli, which is an olive oil mayonnaise, you typically would start with canola oil and then finish with another one, like I do the walnut oil for my Waldorf salad dressing. Great question. Thank you. Anyone else? More questions? Sure. Please step up to the microphone.
Hi. I was just wondering where you saw the future of food and nutrition education, whether it be at schools or in the home, or where and how do you see that happening in the future?
Well, I think it has to start with an interest. I think it has to start with being able to spark some interest in food. And that can happen at a very early age. Since my kids are here, I guess I have the right to embarrass them. We have a picture of us sitting around the living room in France, and they're both in diapers, and we're hulling strawberries. And the strawberries are literally spread out all over the floor, and we're going to make jam. We bought in 2 flats of strawberries. And I think they were probably eating more than they were helping me prepare. But ever since they were, you know, big enough to pick something up, part of what they've been playing with is food. And I think that kind of early exposure would definitely help. Of course, The Edible Schoolyard by Alice Waters is an extremely successful and popular program. So I think probably giving kids the interest is the first step. And then, of course, the things I've talked about, the schools and some structural changes would probably help very quickly along the way. Great. Thank you. More questions?
D'abord, un gros merci pour votre présentation.
Merci beaucoup.
Okay.
Le plaisir est à moi.
I have a two-part question. What is your very, very favorite food? And number two, what is the greatest joy that you take in preparing a dish that you really love
Certainly.
To work with?
Well, that's very simple. My favorite kinds of food are the dishes that cook for hours and hours. Slow-cooked French dishes like a bœuf bourguignon, or a vieille blanquette, or a coq au vin. These kind of dishes give the chef a lot of time to stick the spoon in and stir. And that's what really excites me about food. A pot-au-feu is the same thing, yeah. Because In savory cooking, now pastry is a whole other art, and there's a film I talk about here called Kings of Pastry, a must-see for any foodies. Pastry is an art, and it's a science, too. You can't do a little bit of pinch of this or a little bit of that in a pastry recipe. Once a cake goes into the oven, if something's off, it's not going to bake right. And, of course, a great pastry chef is able to improvise and add their own personal touch. But in the savory part of the kitchen, it's much easier to mess around with it, add a little bit of this, taste it, of course, a lot, and come up with something that's really special. And that's what really I enjoy the most. But I also like these kind of dishes because a lot of times you can turn them on their head. I make a great cassoulet salad, which is, of course, white beans and duck. Gotta love duck. But it's not, in the summer, I don't make it in sauce and warm and simmering away for hours. I make the same dish, but I chill the white beans and separate it out a little bit and serve the duck chilled and some greens and make a great summer dish with the same type of deep, rich savors that you get in a cassoulet. Another question, sir, please.
Yes. Chef, wouldn't you say that it really helps your appreciation of a fine meal at a fine restaurant to have spent some time in the kitchen yourself?
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I like to eat as much as I like to cook, maybe even more so. And I do really enjoy going out, in part because of the service I mentioned, but also because of the experience. Knowing what goes on behind the scenes when you see food on a plate is sometimes really inspirational, and you can understand what went into it. That does help. Another question. Yes, please, sir.
Thanks for a very articulate and witty presentation.
Thank you.
And, well, after what you had to say about duck fat, this question, which would probably be immoral in France, is difficult to ask. But is there a way that a person can go into a French restaurant with what the American mainstream idea of a so-called healthy diet in mind. And, you know, I'll say that that probably means little or no saturated fats, so the butters, the creams,
sure.
Heavy milks are out, cheeses are out. Complex carbohydrates,
sure.
These things. Is there anything that one can say where you will not be laughed out of there and you come out having a good meal and still feeling healthy?
Sure. I think you could probably share. That's a great way to experience a number of different dishes and not overeat. Fats are, as I was saying in the story, they're not necessarily evil. And in fact, there's a lot of vitamins that are only fat soluble. There are a lot of essential fatty acids. So we actually need some fats. It comes back to what I was saying about moderation. A little bit goes a long way. Another thing that helps in Paris is the restaurant you've walked into, odds are that you walked there, right? So you probably spent 10 or 15 minutes on foot and got some exercise. And you're going to spend not 30 or 45 minutes there, but maybe an hour or maybe two or three. And so you're not likely to be eating again real soon. So you're probably going to be spreading your meals out more. But when you go into the restaurant and you say you would like something light and fresh, you can definitely find those kind of dishes in Paris. There are lots of restaurants that have them. And the bistro cuisine, which is more of the steak frites. France has its own, unfortunately, version of the hamburger and French fries that we have. That kind of food often is not quite as healthy as people would like. But in many restaurants, you can find very, very healthy dishes, definitely. With the microphone, please, ma'am, if you wouldn't mind stepping up to the microphone.
Would you share with us some of your experiences as a personal chef? What is your process as a personal chef, and has it changed your relationship with food at all?
Well, most of my clients come from word of mouth. I have a website, and I do some mailings and things like that, but it's mostly word of mouth, people that I've met or who are friends of friends. And so very often I will meet with the client ahead of time and in their home, and from the very beginning, it's not just about the food that we're going to have. It's about the event. So I'm going to ask the people who's coming. We're going to talk about the decorations. We're going to talk about the kind of food, how the overall evening is going to play out. And this has really reinforced my understanding of the value of a good meal. And so I find clients in lots of different places. One of the best events I ever worked for was an engagement ceremony in France, and it was a friend of a friend, and he set up a very special dinner with his family, and he didn't tell his wife that he was going to propose. And I'm coming around with food right when I can tell he's getting ready to do it. And so rather than scoot out of the dining room and try and make way, he stood up while I was there with his family and guests for the dinner and thanked me for the incredible experience and how it really made what he was going to say perfect. And then he proceeded to propose to his wife. So it's really been, you know, being a personal chef has been an extremely rewarding experience for me. One more question?
Time,
yeah.
We have time for just one question.
One more question. Great.
Would you care to share a few of your choices on this side of the bay for the French restaurants?
Favorite restaurants?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I have two places that I will recommend, and the food is great. Only one of them is French. But the main reason I recommend these two places is because the chefs, as I said earlier, are always in the kitchen. When you go to these restaurants, you'll see the chef, whether you go there in the middle of the afternoon or in the evening or the first thing in the morning. The two restaurants that are probably my best recommendations in San Francisco are Pane e Vino, the chef Bruno Quicierni, Italian, fantastic trattoria-style food. And then the other one is Chapeau. Well, formerly Chapeau, went to Clementine's, now it's Chapeau again. Philippe Gardel, great French chef, really, really fantastic. If you eat at a place like this and you see the chef and see how hard he works, you can tell whether you're there all day or there for just for dinner. You can understand the passion that places like this and chefs like these have for great food. Thank you very much. Have a nice evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much, EJ.
Please come and taste the mayonnaise if you'd like and get a recipe on your way out.
Yes, I was going to say that instead of signing a book, you're going to get a signed carrot, which you can dip into the mayonnaise. Well, that ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion. We thank everybody for coming very much.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.